good morning, world diners and travelers, and good morning to Peter.
Good morning, and this is a special program, right?
Yes, this is a special version or program of On the Menu, the very first time we've done this. It's a bonus program because we wanted to get the information to you as quickly as possible about the Virginia Wine Festival.
All about all the excitement of Virginia Wine Month, and we're still in Virginia. As we prepare this program, because we wanted to bring it to you, so we're trying a whole new system, and you'll know if you hear this program whether the system was successful or not.
Exactly.
Let's talk to Richard Lewis. Yeah, representative of the Virginia Tourist Corporation who helped us to put the visit together. The 40th anniversary of one of the original state tourism themes in the United States. Virginia is for lovers. The anniversary of that designation is 40 years ago next year. But that's not why On the Menu's in Virginia just now, because we're celebrating a different anniversary, the 20th anniversary of an event that celebrates the grape in Virginia. So Virginia is for wine lovers. And Richard Lewis from the Virginia Tourism Corporation, who's organized a wonderful tour for us here in Virginia. I'm going to ask you, Richard, just tell us about what's involved in Virginia Wine Month and when people come, what it is they'll be able to experience.
Well, October has been designated as Virginia Wine Month because that is when the harvest comes in, and that's when the celebration of the new vintage is coming in and being processed into the barrel. Plus, it's one of the most beautiful times of year here in Virginia. And so 20 years ago, October was designated as Virginia Wine Month. And people who are coming into the state to tour the wineries and enjoy the wonderful things that go on there will find festivals. You will find special activities, tours, tastings. And most of all, the beautiful Virginia fall weather as the leaves change and the temperatures drop. It's really one of the most beautiful times of year to visit the state.
Now, is it still going to be possible for people to get accommodations? I mean, it's a very busy time of the year, especially with the autumn leaves and everything. And we've heard that in the section where the leaf show is perhaps the best, you have to book a year in advance in order to be able to have a place to stay.
Well, you know, the secret is to plan ahead, and you can certainly still get accommodations in Virginia almost everywhere you go. But let me throw out a really good resource, and that is the Virginia Tourism Corporation website, which is virginia.org. And if you go on there, you will have everything you will need to plan a trip into Virginia at any time of year, but especially during the fall.
Now, there's also a website for the Virginia Wine Month itself also, I believe.
Go to that same website, virginia.org, but put a /wine behind the end of that, and you will have all of the information about Virginia Wine Month.
Now, wine in Virginia is an interesting story because one of your famous favorite sons made a number of attempts to start wine because he was a wine lover.
In fact, Thomas Jefferson, I don't know the exact quote, but said something to the effect that he didn't see how he could live without wine. So one of the things he tried to do at Monticello was to grow his own wine grapes and to become a winemaker, but he failed at that. One of the few enterprises that he was not successful at, he brought in Italian vintners, and they were just simply unable to start a wine crop there at Monticello. He may have been a little early because he would be so pleased now to see what's happened in Virginia with nearly 140 wineries operating in the state.
Well, I think the answer might have been that he was trying to use rootstock from, was it Italy or from France? The winemakers were Italian, but were the grapes French?
I believe the grapes were French, and it apparently the climate was just not suitable in the Monticello area. But there is a vineyard now on the site where he was trying to grow his grapes.
And we're going to have to try to go to school here. I think what happened is people developed the cultivation of wines and realized that they could graft any grape variety they wanted onto a rootstock that would work in the soil of the area. And I have it on good authority, this much I know, that in fact it was Native American vine rootstock that was used to restore the wineries in those parts of the world that were affected by phylloxera in the later part of the 19th century. But I guess Thomas didn't know that trick.
No, in fact, he would have been fascinated by that, though being the Renaissance man that he was. But today, grapes are thriving in almost every region of Virginia, but particularly in the Piedmont area east of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Now, when you say Piedmont, that's it's sort of like the Piedmont in North Carolina. I mean, it's hilly, but it's still not the mountains.
It's hilly and provides that the slopes that the grapes like to grow on, and the exposure to the sun. And the gently rolling terrain is also makes for excellent, beautiful scenic drives in the country. And one of the pleasures of going to Virginia wineries is the fact that they are located in such bucolic, lovely places. And you can drive from one to the other, do tours and tastings, and you can even have a meal and even stay overnight at some of our wineries.
Well, we're certainly going to be doing our share of that, and some of this program and programs to follow are going to talk about the specific adventures that we had that Richard and his colleagues have planned out for us. But to put a dot on a map, just so that everyone knows where we are actually now in Charlottesville, the home of the University of Virginia, much founded by and much beloved by Thomas Jefferson. And is this the most convenient place to really center your tour?
Well, if you want to get the most wineries in a certain number of days, then certainly the Charlottesville region going north, slightly northeastward toward the town of Leesburg. That is the real corridor for wineries in Virginia. But you will also find them in the Shenandoah Valley. You may even find wineries on the eastern shore of Virginia, some in Southside Virginia also. But by far the greatest concentration is on the corridor between Charlottesville and Leesburg.
Now, what are some of the top names in Virginia wines, Richard?
I think Barbersville is certainly one of the top. It's one of the largest producing vineyards in Virginia. It's also one of the most popular. They have a terrific restaurant. They have a wonderful overnight lodging there. And they also have the ruins of the Barber House. It's the last house that Thomas Jefferson designed. It burned in the 1800s, leaving a few exterior walls and columns, and they now use it as a backdrop for Shakespeare Theater in the summer. So the Barbersville experience is one that we heartily recommend, and their wines, and this is one of the oldest wineries dating back to the 1970s, their wines are among some of the most honored in Virginia. So that's one of many that I could recommend.
Now there's another one called Horton, I think. Horton's very well known.
Horton Vineyards is just outside of Charlottesville, and it is also a winery that is starting to accumulate a lot of national awards for its wine, and it has a very pleasing experience if you go to visit the winery itself.
Now, the city of Charlottesville itself is really quite a charmer, isn't it?
Charlottesville is a city that is so noted for its history, and you mentioned the University of Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson and Edgar Allan Poe have walked there, among others. And in fact, the room that Poe used as a student is still maintained there by the Poe Society. You'll see a stuffed raven in it if you have trouble finding it. But Charlottesville also has got a terrific nighttime vibe. Some of the very, very favorite night spots, restaurants, clubs are here on the Main Street Mall, which is a pedestrian mall. You'll find some of the best restaurants in Virginia here in Charlottesville as well.
And I just read about a very special event that's going to be happening in a facility on the University of Virginia campus. Anne doesn't even know this yet because I only just found this out. I just got back to interview Richard. Elton John is coming to Charlottesville on October 17th. So if you are interested in building a wine month visit around an iconic rock presentation, that would be a good time to come, wouldn't it?
You could come here and see Sir Elton John one night, the next morning get up and go to a winery. You may even do a hot air balloon tour here, by the way. There are several hot air balloon services here that you can organize a tour by.
And you must be a bit of a fan of the music of our era, I think, because a few minutes ago you told me that you heard the Rolling Stones playing here in Charlottesville too.
Yes, about 3 years ago the Rolling Stones played here at the football stadium. First time I had been to a big time rock and roll concert in probably 20 years. And I was really amazed by the fact that my ears weren't ringing the next day. So either I've lost my hearing totally, or else the sound systems now are much more efficient.
Well, you were probably also somewhat into the experience, I would guess, right? You were always a fan?
This was the third time I had seen the Rolling Stones. The first time I saw them was in 1971, and the second in 75. So it had been a while. We've all aged.
They're still. I can't believe Mick Jagger and I are almost exactly the same age, and I hope I look better than he does.
Peter, you do.
Charlie Watts is just, he looks like he's been mummified.
Now, let me tell you something about Charlie Watts. He is a big fan of the American Civil War. He's quite the history buff.
I didn't know that.
So I would not be surprised if while they were here, he took in a couple of Virginia's Civil War battlefields.
Well, we're going to have to be careful to get distracted from Virginia Mind Month if we're not careful.
Absolutely.
Because you're such a mine of information about everything that's going on in Virginia, and we're going to keep some secrets until it's time to more of what On the Menu is going to be doing to explore Virginia history. We'll give you a clue. It's Virginia history. Yeah. But back to Virginia Wine Month. What kinds of events are going to be happening?
You will find special events at some of the wineries themselves, and again, go to the virginia.org/wine site, and you will see a complete listing of Virginia Wine Month events. But there are also larger festivals that take place elsewhere, where 20 and or perhaps 25 or 30 wineries may come together. And one such is the Virginia Hot Air Balloon and Wine Festival, which is held in October. As the name implies, there is a gathering of hot air balloons and a gathering of wineries, and it is a two-day event, which is superb. We've been to it several times. Plenty of food, even a lot of kids' activities. And that's one thing we want to mention about Virginia wineries is the wineries themselves very often have things for kids to do. So don't be bashful about coming with the family.
Now, in the hot air balloon thing, you can get a ride, but you don't have to drive yourself, I hope.
No, you will have an experienced pilot, such as they are.
who's not drinking wine.
So whichever way the wind blows, we hope you will have a happy landing somewhere in Virginia.
Well, we're looking forward to several days of the experience, and we're going to bring you, of course, interviews from all of those before Virginia Wine Month begins, so that firsthand you'll hear from some of the people that you might meet when you come here. But it sounds like there's still time to get accommodations. There's still time to plan.
There is absolutely still time to plan and to get accommodations. And whether you have a weekend or you have time for just a day trip or a more extended trip, you can easily plan that trip here. Look for country inns on back roads. Some of Virginia's very best accommodations are out in the middle of nowhere. You'll see some of those places on your tour here as you go through. Large cities, small cities, you'll find very good accommodation and excellent dining almost everywhere you go in Virginia.
Now, the dining thing is it relatively new?
Well, I think one of the things that is really putting Virginia on the map in terms of culinary excellence are the number of chefs here who are dedicating themselves to using local product. The locavores, as they're called, and there are many places here in Virginia who everything that you see on the menu will come from one certain farm. And I think that's really important to people now, is to make sure that they're getting the fresh local ingredients and not something that's coming from the other side of the world that's been frozen and packaged and put away. New restaurants are joining the old favorites here in Virginia to really give you a good cross selection.
I'm just going to depend on the side because I'm sitting over here. Doesn't Michael Pollan in his book talk about a place in Virginia? I think so. I think there was a farm in Virginia that he visited. It's just Michael Pollan. What was the name of his book?
The Omnivore's Dilemma.
And I think that this was one of the visits that he made was to a totally green, totally biodynamic farm property that was raising things that would grow properly in Virginia.
He almost certainly was talking about a place called Polyface Farm, which is over in the Valley of Virginia, that is... It's really almost a shrine to sustainable farming. where not only do they rotate the crops, but they rotate the livestock there in a manner that sustains the whole thing.
It's interesting when you think back to the origins of, I guess, it's hard to call it modern settlement, but the European settlements that began here in Virginia, that the people who founded them, several of them simply died out. They got sick, they starved because they couldn't grow crops, and now you have an incredibly fertile commonwealth.
Well, we're so fortunate now. The starving time that the original settlers faced in Jamestown is long ago. And
thank goodness for that.
if you're starving now, it's your own fault, because there's so much in Virginia. There's such a bounty here. We're richly blessed in the Commonwealth.
So put it on your calendar, listeners. Virginia Wine Month in Virginia all the way through the month of October. Come and have a wonderful time. And if you're still not certain, listen to the rest of this program and to an upcoming program so you can find out more from the people themselves. Richard, a last thought for listeners?
Please come to Virginia. You will have a wonderful time here no matter when you come, be it Virginia Wine Month this October or next year for the 40th anniversary of Virginia's for Lovers. But we urge you to come and live passionately. That is our new thought, is live passionately and travel with passion. You will find your passion here in Virginia.
So that's it, listeners. Virginia is for wine lovers, so beat the trail to Virginia while you have the chance.
Well, I know it's time to take a break, but I want to say, first of all, that this countryside is so gorgeous. I can hardly stand it. It's so beautiful. But anyhow, let's just take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Welcome back again to a very special program about Virginia Wine Month, our bonus program.
And of course, since it's about Virginia wine,
we went to vineyards.
We went to a couple of vineyards. Only one we were able to record at, and it turns out it's a vineyard with a rather interesting popular music connection.
Peter Matthews and Peter Haig, more than one thing in common. Turns out, of course, we share the same first name, but not only that, we discovered that in our educational background is very similar, because we both have master's degrees in geography, and you know what I do with mine, and what Peter decided to do with his, since you really can't make a living as a geographer drawing maps. He decided that a great thing to do would be to become a winemaker. Now, he might have been helped a little bit along the way, because his big brother had bought a property on which you can do that, and that's another Matthews. You can probably guess that he has a band named after him, and his first name starts with D, and he was the one who bought this property a few years ago, and in the year 2000, the family decided it was time to make wine, so they planted grapes. Peter Matthews, welcome to On the Menu.
Hello.
Now, what was it that really decided you that you ought to become a winemaker?
I thought it was fairly related to geography, and geography is a fairly general subject, and I thought it would be enjoyable.
And you took over a vineyard where there was already a winemaker in place, and you brought in another person. What's that been like? I mean, it's a really hands-on thing to be doing without maybe a lot of experience?
In some ways, especially the dealing with the diseases has been a challenge. But I think I've gotten better over the years. I wasn't actually in charge of the winemaking. I'm more the vineyard.
Okay, so you decided to bring a winemaker on board, and tell us who that is.
It's Kirsty Harmon, and we decided that we needed a trained winemaker, especially partly to deal with, you know, the difficulties of making wine in this climate.
So there are some special challenges in Virginia, perhaps some like Thomas Jefferson experienced when he tried and failed several times?
Yes. Especially maybe because of the warm climate, the dealing with the acidity, the drop in acidity that's caused by the warm night.
Okay, so Virginia, in fact, is unusual in that it's both warm and relatively wet for growing grapes. So Kirsty Harmon, you came about being a winemaker in a somewhat unusual way, being half English, and you know, that doesn't exactly come with a winemaking tradition either. But how did you get started?
I actually was a yeast geneticist by trade. So after school, I worked in a yeast genetics lab for a few years. and then just by chance decided to change careers a little bit and fell into winemaking, where I learned winemaking from Gabriele Rausi. And then after a few years of helping him make his wine, we decided to expand my education. So I went to UC Davis in California, spent 2 years getting a master's there, and then spent 6 months in France, 3 months in New Zealand, and then was hired here at Blenheim Vineyards.
You had learned your winemaking in Virginia, and the person whose name you mentioned is really very well known hereabouts.
Yeah, Gabriele. I was lucky enough to meet Gabriele early on in my winemaking, I guess, career, before I even knew it was going to be my career. And his passion for winemaking kind of just took over and infected me and made me really excited about winemaking and wanted to make it a career, to change careers.
And what's the winemaking elements that you're working on here at Blenheim Vineyard?
The winemaking elements, well, trying to understand the fruit that we're getting from Blenheim Vineyards and from some of the other vineyards we've purchased fruit from, trying to understand how best to express the place and where those grapes have come from and how that translates to a bottle of wine and how you kind of get the consumer to understand where the grapes came from, how they're special, why they're special, and how that all contributes to what they're drinking in that bottle.
Now, we were talking earlier about Cal David's program, which is very well known and sometimes a little bit criticized for being extraordinarily scientific. So you have that side of it, but you have another feeling for how wine should be made.
Well, I was making wine with Gabriele for 5 years before going to UC Davis. So UC Davis was terrific in giving me the foundation and kind of understanding why I was doing certain things in the winery at certain times. So really gave me that scientific basis to understand what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. But there's no better place to learn winemaking than in the winery. You've got to be very hands-on, and that's nothing anything from a book can teach you. You actually have to do the work. But to understand what you're doing and understand how what you're doing affects the final product, you definitely need a sign. And Davis is a great place to get that.
From your own experience here, this property is growing. All of Virginia winemaking seems to be growing as well. What do you attribute that?
It's a beautiful place to be. I think a lot of people are deciding to retire here or to make their lives here. Schultz was a terrific place, and it's a great place to grow grapes. I think as, you know, maybe over the past 25 years, more and more people have come to this area, been able to invest in a piece of vineyard, and they've done really well with it. And I think people are coming into this area, seeing that model, seeing how successful it is, and thinking, well, I can do that too. I think once they get into it and get involved in it, they realize just how much work it is. But on the outside, it seems like a very romantic, a very beautiful lifestyle to have. And it is. There's a lot of hard work that goes on behind the scenes.
So it's a little bit like the craze that was California in the 1960s and 1970s.
Sure. We see a lot of that. I mean, we've certainly improved in quality and improved in you know, our reputation over the last few years, and that's just going to increase from here on out.
Talk to us about the portfolio of wines that Blenheim Vineyard produces.
This year we will produce roughly 3,500 cases, roughly half white, half red. So our whites are Chardonnay and Viognier, and the reds are Petit Verdot, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, a little bit of Malbec, some Syrah, so a blend of lots of different grapes. The focus is to have the wines really speak for themselves, so not much, you know, influence from oak, just to kind of balance things out, but really express the fruit that's here.
And people can buy these wines through your website, and you ship?
Absolutely. You can buy it from our website at www.blenheimvineyards.com, or you can come to the winery. We're open currently by appointment only, but with plans in the next few months to open daily for tastings and tours.
Now, the Viognier sounds really interesting. This is a new project, and it's a grape that everyone seems to be falling in love with all over again, but we understand it's also a rather fickle grape. It can be rather difficult to grow.
Sure, I think it seems to be more susceptible to drought. It seems to have some issues with set sometimes, but when the grapes come in and you start to smell those fermentations, it's well worth all the hard work. It's a beautifully fragrant and floral and exciting grape to work with, and it's a winemaker's challenge to be able to capture that and to have that persist through a bottle.
Now, does that exist in vineyards in years before 2008, or will 2008 be the first?
There has been some Viognier made under the label of Blenheim Vineyards, but this next year, actually 2009, will be the first year that we have Viognier from Blenheim Vineyards. So we have some Viognier this year from some other grape growers. So next year will be our first year of Viognier from Blenheim Vineyards Farm Vineyard.
Now, Peter, what does the future hold for for Blenheim Vineyards?
I'm looking at sourcing grapes from a cooler climate in the Shenandoah Valley. At least maybe a third of our grape. And the other thing is, I'm also thinking about planting hot climate grapes where the acidity would hold up, you know, to the warm night, like sort of odd Portuguese varieties like Tintacao and Verdelho. So it's maybe a sort of a two-pronged strategy there.
So there are, sounds like there are really some great adventures ahead, Kirsten.
Absolutely, and I'm so excited to be here for it. This is the first winery I've worked for where I'm kind of in charge of the winemaking, and yeah, we've got great challenges and excitement ahead.
That must be quite a responsibility. I mean, you say I've been just doing this for 5 years and 10 years, but you seem to me like an extraordinarily young person still. And here's Peter, who's a young person as well. So you're going to be doing this a long time?
Yes.
Absolutely.
So Blenheim Vineyards, put it on your map, put blenheimvineyards.com on your wine purchasing list, and enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's now take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We are again.
Miss Anne was asleep at the wheel, that was just in case you're wondering. But
there are so many things happening. We are going to have to update you later. We hit the Kluge vineyard at the height of harvest, so we couldn't catch the owners, and they will be calling in a later date. I can't say enough about the how beautiful the landscape is driving around this part of Virginia.
So yesterday afternoon we made quite a long ride up and over the first set of mountains into the Shenandoah Valley, up the Shenandoah Valley to Luray, which
and
is the home of
Skyline Drive is under reconstruction or something.
Is it? I don't know. I mean, we crossed Skyline Drive rather than driving on it, so I don't really know the answer to that question. But we caught up with the next place of call was the Mimslin Inn, which is a really rather splendid but recently renovated establishment. And as luck would have it, a very interesting couple who own the hotel and who have restored it were here. So we got a chance to talk to them.
That was fun.
And we also got a chance this morning, having had dinner here last night, we had a chance to talk to the chef. So that's what's coming up in the next segment of the program.
Listeners, by now you realize, if you've been a frequent listener to On the Menu, that On the Menu's life seems to be filled with coincidences and what I call serendipitous moments. So we're staying this evening, and we're about to dine at the Mimslin Inn in Luray, in north central Virginia, a place that's best known for its caves, but it's a very smart town. And all of Luray is out this evening at the Mimslin Inn because there's a big fundraiser for downtown restoration here in the little town of Luray. But that's not the coincidence. The coincidence is that we met the owner of this hotel, who also owns the Bavarian Inn in Shepherdstown, probably 100 miles or so away from here, in a different direction from Washington, D.C. And his wife, Carol, is from Sheffield, 25 miles from where Peter was born. Now, I don't know whether that's a coincidence or serendipity, but it certainly is a lot of fun. We're talking this evening to Irvin, pronounced Irvin as in Germany, but really spelled E-R-W-I-N, who came to the United States in 1959. And Irvin, I just want you to tell your story.
All right. Yes, as you said, in 1959, and I came to the United States. Previously to that, I went to hotel school in Bavaria. I spent 2 years in Paris, working in the restaurant hotel field, mostly in the restaurant. I was so-called front man, meaning that I don't take credit as being a chef, although I love to cook and I love wines. But so I cannot take credit as an executive chef. However, I know a little bit something about the kitchen. And I had my first restaurant in Washington, D.C. when I was 24 years old, and then continued after that, eventually met my wife, because it just so happened that this German actually ran an English restaurant. It was called the Piccadilly. And can you imagine a German running an English restaurant? However, I knew all about beefsteak and kidney pie, a Yorkshire pudding. We had trifle for dessert. We had Welsh rabbit. We had all those good things. So anyway, I was so successful that I could eventually purchase myself an estate out in the country. And I made out of this very nice big house a great inn. It's called the Bavarian Inn in Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
So you actually established the Bavarian Inn at the very beginning?
Yes, indeed. It was a house, a very nice gray stone mansion, but it only had about five rooms. So what we did is we turned the basement into a Ratskeller, and then we had the first floor was two dining rooms of a total of about 60 seats. And we actually lived above the shop, so to speak, you know. And eventually we were able to get a good government loan and then increase. So first we had 27 hotel rooms while we still lived above the shop. Then eventually we built our own house. And we had won over the years all kinds of rewards. Now we have turned it around. So the Bavarian Inn now has 72 hotel rooms. It can seat about 300 people. And it has won the Four Diamond Award as well as the Wine Spectre Grand Award.
But then something funny happened. Your sons got into the business too. So yes. So you said, well, okay, you run the Bavarian Inn, but I'll still be around. And then tell us what happened then. They said, Dad, you have to do something different.
Yes, they quickly realized that Dad is interfering too much, you know. He's checking that all the salt and pepper shakers are filled in the dining room. The napkins have to be folded properly. I think it irritated them a little bit. So anyway, they said, you know, Dad, there is that Mimslin Inn in Luray, Virginia. It's for sale. It's kind of dilapidated and it's very poor, but I'm sure you could fix that up. Sort of a challenge, you know. I said, so you boys obviously going to come down and help me fix up the place? Well, I haven't seen him too much, really. However, we have now managed to have a really fine kitchen and dining room at the Mimslin Inn here in Luray. That's where we're talking from right now. And today we have Downtown Initiative. About 250 people are being here. And everybody's just having a wonderful time. We are still working on a great wine list. So far we have received the Wine Spectator Award, but not the Grand Award. And we have a great executive chef. You might hear from him some other time. But anyway, we are just very happy to be here. And within 2.5 years, out of a place that nobody would want to go into, we thought we really have decided to make a great place out of that.
Well, there's absolutely no question that you did that. Now, I can remember being at the Bavarian Inn. It must have been about 25 years ago when it was much smaller than it is today. We did get a lightning update from our son and our wonderful daughter-in-law, Jennifer, because they spent their short two-night honeymoon there 3 years ago and really enjoyed it. And we're invited there, so I'm sure at some point we'll find our way there. But let's come back to Luray and the Mims family property, the Mimslin Inn, and talk a little bit more about why people might come to Luray and what the experience is going to be like when they're here.
Okay, now the most famous attraction always has been and so far still is, of course, is the Luray Caverns. The largest caverns by far on the whole East Coast. They're absolutely famous. They've been discovered in the 1930s. And the Mimslin Inn was actually opened at a time of a depression, if you will, in between 1930 and 31. And things were pretty poor at the United States at the time. However, the Mims family had enough money to create this wonderful inn here. It is a beautiful stone building. It has great stone walls, a very solid building. And it gained a very good reputation very fast. Unfortunately, it was sold several times and fell on poor hands, and there was just no money available, and it fell into bad, ill repair. And so 2.5 years ago, I purchased the place and invested, of course, a lot of money. But now we are very happy to be here because it's once again the Grand Old Inn of Virginia, as it used to be called.
And the same kind of people come here, they go to the Bavarian Inn, and they're coming for a weekend away, or they're coming for a business meeting here or something like that?
Yes. The place does almost every weekend a wedding now, which is, you know, it's a wonderful wedding place for the reason that there is that winding stairway that the bride can come down. It's like Gone with the Wind, you know, one of those southern hospitality places. Even the menu reflects it somewhat. Of course, we have no longer just mashed potato and grits and ham steaks. No, it's a very elegant first-class kitchen that we run here now. However, the southern influence is everywhere. We like to think that the elegance is there, and really, like in Gone with the Wind, you can come down the stairways there, and you'll have a heck of a wedding.
So you might not go to the Luray Caverns at all. You might just enjoy the experience of being here.
Oh yes, well, you know, I would recommend to anybody, you know, you should visit the Luray Caverns. It's fantastic, really, what they have down there. As a matter of fact, they do weddings down there as well. There are weddings performed almost every week down in the Luray Caverns. However, if you wish to have the elegance, the hotel rooms and all that, unfortunately, we only have 45 hotel rooms, but they're all very nice. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them have a fireplace, a jacuzzi bathtub, and all the luxury they can possibly think of is here now. And there's also a spa here that my wife really appreciates. Downstairs is a wonderful spa where you can get your massage of any kind, and hot stones and everything else. Thank you.
Well, the girls have been kind of left out of this, so I wanted to say something. I think that these people are so delightful listeners that you know you're going to have a great time because they are just the brightest, most fun people you'd ever want to meet. And Carol has not been actually... I'd like for you to tell us a little about the spa program.
I'm Carol Ozum, and you might get a slight detection of my voice, the same as Peter's, a little bit. And this way, we are, as he said, almost neighbors, just across the border, a little ones. But... Luray is just a lovely, lovely place to visit. And since we renovated the Mims Lane Inn, it's got this wonderful old, almost Englishy charm about it with the big heavy drapes and the chandeliers. But we're trying to put on a modern twist too, which seems to be the trend these days that people want to do a spa treatment. So we have the spas and they have numerous types of services that you put your own menu together for your service in the spa. Plus, we do have an outdoor pool, and as long as the weather stays cooperative, we're now into the middle of or towards the end of September. Happily, the pool is still open, the sun is still out and shining, and it's a great experience. And what is becoming very vogue right now is these girlfriend weekends or during the week. This would be an absolute perfect place for not only the young sort of bridesmaids that want to go away for a bridesmaid's time, but for old girlfriends that just want to chat about old times or just read a book and just lay there and have a massage. So... we can highly recommend it.
Well, I'd like to do one of those with you. We should. Okay, we're scheduled. Anyhow, that's what I can contribute to this. I'm passing it back to Peter.
Well, thank you so much. And it's so much fun to have an English voice on the program in addition to mine. The information that you need is in order to be able to find out more details and be able to book is www.BavarianInn.com. This is in Shepherdstown, West Virginia.com. And the Mims Lane Inn is www.mimslyn. Let me start that again. YLNINN.com. A last word, Erwin?
Well, I just hope anybody who wants to check us out here, please come, have a good time. You know, it's all about having good food and most of all have a wonderful place to stay in. And we're certainly hoping to come here and relax and have a wonderful time. Thank you.
And we'll be reporting on the food experience because we're interviewing your chef tomorrow before we leave. So what a fortunate meeting to have a chance to say hello to the boss. That's always fun. And boss says, oh yeah, I'm in trouble. Yeah, the real boss Carol just spoke up in the background, and she also told us that she used to be a cipher clerk in the Secret Service. So, but that's a story for another day. Maybe she's not even allowed to talk about that.
No, I think that's it.
we've done enough already, and it's time for dinner. And in any case, Erwin and Carol have to go back to the big party.
Yes. Well, after we had our wonderful conversation with the owners, we retired, as Peter says, to the Speakeasy, which is the casual restaurant in this. The formal dining room is Circa 31. Is that how you say that? I'm asking this question of the chef, Richard Meller. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Yes, it's Circa 31.
And why is it named that?
It's the era in which the hotel opened, 1931.
I see.
They finished construction and opened the doors.
And we went downstairs because Lorray was having a big party last night.
Yes, we had a Lorray Downtown Initiative silent auction and benefit dinner.
Yeah, and boy, they were having a good time, Richard.
They sure were. They ate quite a bit of food, and it was a pleasure to provide all that for them.
They also made quite a lot of noise.
They were rousing. Anyhow, let's talk a little bit about you. You are a native Virginian. Tell us a little bit. You were born where, and where'd you go to school, or how'd you get into this business, and how'd you get here?
I was actually born in Hampton General Hospital, native of Gloucester, Virginia. I grew up on a 500-acre farm.
Oh, you're a farm boy.
My grandparents purchased a farm, and my grandfather had a cow dairy, and as my mother grew up, she opened a grade A goat dairy. Sold pasteurized goat's milk from Richmond to Virginia Beach in grocery stores and health food stores.
Of course, now it's all mainstream, huh?
Right. Yep. I got my food passion from my grandmother and my uncle growing up. They always were cooking things. And utilizing the ingredients that we had on the farm.
Well, I spent my summers on my great uncle's dairy farm.
Really?
And with the same kind of experience. And boy, my grandmother, she cooked up a storm for the hands on the farm. And the other thing about a dairy farm is your life's not your own, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's always working to produce the product and keeping everything going.
Yeah, but everything was just so fresh. I mean, I remember the fresh cream, and our neighbors grew berries, and that was, I've never had berries and cream like that since.
Right, and then making, when it snows, you make snow cream.
Ah, yeah.
But fast forward to the culinary career.
Yeah, right. So you have a farm background, so you're right on trend with it, what's happening in the culinary world today. Now, how did you become a chef?
I started school at Johnson & Wales in the late part of 97. As soon as I began school, I got a job at the Williamsburg Inn.
Uh-huh.
And then I moved on from there to Ford's Colony, where I did my externship with Chef David Everett.
Oh, David Everett. Oh, yeah, yeah. Good guy, huh?
Yeah, he's great. I learned wonderful things from him.
He's a good chef, yeah. Okay, and then that was how long ago?
That was in 98.
Okay, and so then what?
I went on as a sous chef at A. Carroll's Bistro in Merchant Square of Williamsburg. Then I wanted to move away, go out west, so I moved to Denver, Colorado, and worked for restaurant Kevin Taylor.
Yeah, Denver. Didn't you like Denver?
Oh, it was great. Lots of snow.
you ski?
Spent most of my time in the restaurant, actually. Didn't even go skiing when I was there.
Oh, really?
I worked basically 7 days a week for Kevin Taylor.
And then how did you end up back here?
I moved back. Wanted to come and work for the Williamsburg Marriott, get some high-volume experience.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got some of that last night, too.
Yeah, it was just a little touch, but we used to do plated banquets for over 1,500.
That's high volume.
Yeah, that's high volume. So I was the executive sous chef for Williamsburg Marriott for a year. Then I moved on to as executive chef for Richmond Marriott West. And then I decided I wanted to go back to fine dining, so I became sous chef for Tony Capice at La Grotta Restaurant in downtown Richmond. All handcrafted Northern Italian cuisine. Fresh pastas, game, ostrich, kangaroo.
Yeah, you cooked roux. And then you came here.
Yeah, I came here after working for Tony and Paolo Randozzi. He owns Cincy in downtown Richmond.
Oh, yeah.
Southern Italian. So I was with him for a year.
So you have a lot of Italian influence, huh?
Yeah, that's what pretty much... is my main background, is an Italian.
Now, how would you describe, your cooking style as Southern or?
I'd say it's Southern with a Italian twist on it.
Uh-huh. Well, now, we had a lot to eat. I mean, our mission was to sample as much of this menu as possible, and you were great in helping us with portion controls and platings and so on. If you could just look at some of these dishes that we had and talk a little bit about them. This sounds to me like it might be Southern, is we had the jumbo freshwater shrimp stuffed with fresh mozzarella, wrapped in pancetta with stone ground grits and smoky barbecue sauce.
It's a classical Southern dish, shrimp and grits, but I've put a Italian twist on it, adding the pancetta and the mozzarella to it, and we make our own barbecue sauce here.
Tell me about your grits.
The grits are stone ground.
Are they from Anson? Is it, what's it called, Anson Mills?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I can tell. They're really good, aren't they? What a difference.
Yeah, it's a lot of difference in texture. Has a little bit more bite to it.
I gave Peter something for breakfast today. He was very, very hesitant about it, but finally admitted that it did not taste bad. He's not a grit fan.
Right.
Well, it was very tasty. And now, what about this lobster bisque with cherry and poppy seed foam?
The lobster bisque, we make our own stock in-house from lobster bodies. It gives more depth. You can taste the sea when you have a bowl. You get the nice aroma that you wouldn't get from, say, a base. We add the foam to it.
Yeah, do you like doing foams?
It's nice. It's a lot of people are doing foams. It just lightens the dish.
Yeah, and let's see, fried hazelnut crusted goat cheese medallions with sun dried tomato cream, baby arugula, and white truffle oil.
The goat cheese we blend a few herbs, rosemary and thyme with it. It's a very light dish. The truffle oil complements, the nice flavor on the back of your tongue. And the arugula adds a little spice to it as well.
It's good. Nice presentation. That was top. Yeah. Now, I had a question. We've been having a lot of crab cakes, which I always associate with Maryland and the South anyhow.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, but these are very different. They're more they're firmer. Further north, we end up with almost no binder in them, and they just sort of fall apart. But these, you actually have to cut.
Yes, ma'am. I use a scallop mousse okay. as a binder. There's no mayonnaise. No breadcrumbs in it at all. We whip heavy cream and combine it with egg whites and then add the scallops, which forms a paste, and then you mix the crab in with that. And when it cooks, it seals all together and it actually puffs up quite a bit. and you
so
cook it.
So is that uniquely you or uniquely Southern or Virginian?
That's uniquely a fine dining technique that I learned from Chef Kevin Taylor.
Now, you have a nice range, although edited, of the main courses. You seem to like beef a lot.
Beef is rounded on this menu due to the area that we're in. People want to get their meat and potatoes,
okay,
so to speak. As far as the veal dish that I do, we use local Turner ham from Folks Run Grocery. We wrap the veal tenderloin in that, and it adds great flavor to it as it's finished.
That was an unusual presentation. How about, do you have any word for our listeners, final word?
What we try to do here is to take local ingredients, some ingredients that I grow actually out back in the garden.
Oh, yeah, you have your garden, right?
Yes, ma'am. I would say what's best about food is taking the ingredients you have and letting them speak for themselves, not trying to mask any flavors, being natural and not trying to overpower your food with anything.
Well, it sure was good, and I must tell you, I loved my omelets today. I mean, you know, this morning, egg white only omelets could be really boring, but you had ham in it and bacon and mushrooms and homemade salsa, everything from scratch.
Yes, ma'am. We pride ourselves here in making everything fresh. Again, you get the natural flavor. It's not masked by any preservatives or anything extra.
Well, listen, this is a real discovery, Richard, and thank you so much for taking such good care of us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
And I hope you have fun with the rest of the day here.
Thank you.
Well, welcome back, and we're going to be wrapping up pretty soon now. Be assured that we will have more interviews for you later about this interesting section of the state of Virginia.
And a special celebration that's going on throughout the month of October. So
exactly.
We hope you'll tune into that. We hope you'll enjoy. Yeah. And that
and as they say, another day, another calorie or two, Ravido.
Is that what they say? Another day, another glass of wine. Benjamin Franklin at once said, a day without wine is like a day without sunshine.
Yeah, well, you know,
Thomas Jefferson had something to say about wine on the subject of which I think he said wine is a constant reminder that God loves us, or maybe it was the other way around. But anyway, Virginia Wine Month is a place to be, and we have been delighted so far, and we have more excitement yet on the rest of the trip as we preview that for On the Menu listeners. So
and I'm going to say prickly pear sorbet and let you guess about that.
Okay, and we can't say see you same time, same place next week. It's probably same time, same place tomorrow. But be sure to tune in to upcoming On the Menu broadcasts, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Bye-bye.